I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Marine General Joseph Dunford, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was in Seoul on Monday to reassure South Koreans that the U.S. stands by its ally and hopes to resolve the crisis with North Korea without going to war. President Trump's CIA director and national security advisor also tamped down Trump's tough talk on the Sunday talk shows, saying that war is not imminent. Well, the war of words between Trump and the North Korean leadership has had the region and the world on edge, with Trump telling Kim's regime that if it test fires missiles towards Guam, home to U.S. military bases, it will be an event the likes of which no one has seen before. Now, today, North Korea state media reported that Kim Jong-un would, quote, watch a little more the foolish and stupid conduct of the Yankees, seeming to walk back his threats against Guam. Meanwhile, American officials have been working behind the scenes to de-escalate the crisis, and the U.N. has imposed tough new sanctions on North Korea. Today on the show, the challenges this crisis poses and the options on the table. Joining us is Michael Horowitz. He's professor of political science and associate director of Perry World House at the University of Pennsylvania, co-authored a book titled Why Leaders Fight. Michael Horowitz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And joining us from the Center for Strategic and International Studies is Anthony Cordesman. He's the Arleigh A. Burke Chair in Strategy at CSIS. And Anthony Cordesman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
A pleasure.
Would you say, Anthony Cordesman, we are at least for the moment on the downside of this crisis with North Korea walking back a little bit of its threats?
I think we've had a lot of rhetoric, but it is interesting to note that the United States did virtually nothing to ready its forces, do anything that would indicate we were preparing for a major military initiative. We also are talking about a crisis where people keep referring to missiles, where North Korea is at least a year away from a meaningful ICBM, and where people talked about the use of nuclear weapons as missile warheads, and where it now has no missiles deployed with a nuclear warhead. I think part of this is the crisis is that North Korea is moving towards a nuclear-armed missile force, and it is far more capable today than it was a year ago. So the crisis doesn't really go away. The real crisis is a fundamental change in the security situation on the Korean Peninsula over time, not today's war of words.
Well, let me talk about the war of words, and I'll put this to you, Michael Horowitz. I heard the leader of Guam saying that the president, President Trump's words have worked, and one of the explanations for his tough language was, and this was coming from the White House, he was speaking the words that North Korea understands. Do you think he's backed off the North Korean leadership?
I think one of the striking things in the language that President Trump used to speak to the North Koreans in some ways is that it wasn't that different substantively from the language that other sorts of presidents have used. U.S. presidents have consistently made the point for decades that any North Korean attack on South Korea or the United States would be the end of North Korea. President Trump used coarser language.
Fire and fury,
I think, fire and fury, and then fire and fury like the likes of which the world has never seen, but which is a phrase President Trump likes to use that it seems like he sort of tossed in, that he uses in lots of contexts. And so it's not clear to me that it was his language in particular, as opposed to the general credibility of the U.S. commitment to South Korea. But honestly, it's hard to say because it's hard to know anything when it comes to understanding what influences North Korean behavior.
But we didn't see the U.S. military moving towards North Korea, for instance, or the peninsula there.
No, and Dr. Cordesman's absolutely right. We didn't see the removal of the dependence of U.S. troops in South Korea. We didn't see evacuations of U.S. citizens. We didn't see aircraft carriers moving toward the Korean Peninsula or Guam being reinforced militarily, all of which would be signals that the U.S. military and diplomatic enterprise believed that war was imminent.
Anthony Cordesman, do we pay too much attention to the rhetoric, to the words?
I think we do pay too much attention to the rhetoric because the issue ultimately is not simply rhetoric. It's not even mind reading, and we've just heard a very good point raised there. I think the key issue is what are the actual capabilities? And these capabilities are evolving more rapidly than anybody believed even 6 months ago in terms of North Korea's long-range missile booster capability. And it certainly is making advances in terms of nuclear weapons. But when you look at what is happening here, it's been going on in some ways for decades. The real difference is that they seem to have gotten new rocket engines, possibly from the Ukraine, that do give them probably an advance in an ICBM capability. And they may have tested a reentry vehicle. Now, these are important steps, but they're a very long way from having an actual operational missile. And similarly, showing a sort of simulated small nuclear warhead doesn't really mean you have one. And no one in the intelligence community, and here words do count, has said they have such a warhead. What they have said is they have the capability to design and manufacture one.
Reminds me of some of the language that came out of Iraq before the war there. One of the things, Anthony Cordesman, that you have written about, a really interesting article about North Korea's military arsenal, is that it's aging. It looks like a lot of the military equipment from the Vietnam War era. And does that mean that we should be less concerned about its potential threat to the U.S.?
I think when you talk potential threat to the U.S., to do that, they need probably to have a series of tests of a real ICBM. They can't do that with a high apogee or high altitude test of the kind they've had to date. Mm-hmm. To predict reliability and accuracy, they have to test it with a warhead which is exactly, aside from using fissile nuclear material, the warhead that would be on a real nuclear-armed ICBM. And they have to have the ability to predict its reliability and accuracy. Now, that's probably at least a year away. But what really counts here is they probably got between 30 to 60 nuclear weapons already that they could deliver potentially with aircraft, that they'll be able to put on missiles they've already proven far sooner. And even though it's a relatively limited military force in terms of modern aircraft, the best ships, the best surface-to-air missiles, it is a massive machine and one that can deliver a vast amount of firepower near the border and a lot of it against the capital of South Korea. And what they're doing long before they threaten us is directly threatening South Korea and Japan and potentially provoking a broad arms race throughout Northeast Asia.
Let me give you a chance, Michael Horowitz, to weigh in on this. We've been focusing on their nuclear capability, but also the fact that they do have these conventional weapons. And Seoul is, what, 25 miles or so south of this border?
About 35. But I wanted to chime in particular on the point about North Korea's ICBM capabilities, and that I think it's important here to distinguish between when North Korea could acquire the type of reliable capability that's the sort that, say, the United States would have. You know, we could definitely deliver this missile and the warhead will definitely explode. It will work exactly the way that we want. And what North Korea may need for the purposes of being able to threaten the United States or deter the United States. And that North Korea's needs from a reliability perspective are a lot lower than the needs, say, that the United States had with regard to the Soviet Union during the Cold War. They just need a risk. They just need the risk that they can hold the United States at risk, that they could potentially launch a nuclear weapon against Los Angeles or against Washington, D.C. And so that's one of the reasons why their missile developments are so troubling. It's not that they've demonstrated the reliable capacity to launch an ICBM. It's that they've demonstrated that some capacity may exist, and that risk is new.
But do they want these weapons because they want to attack the United States or to defend itself from the threat that they perceive from the United States?
Those are two sides of the same coin in some ways in the nuclear realm, in that they certainly, I mean, what North Korea wants and what the Kim regime wants is to exist. And they have to know that if they ever launched a missile at the United States, North Korea would cease to exist as a country. So in that way, North Korea's weapons are made for deterrent purposes. But on the other hand, the only way that that deterrent is credible is if they are willing to use them, which means willing to actually launch them in a crisis.
Do we know that?
And
we don't know that.
We don't know that. One of the things we're all very lucky about is that we haven't actually had to experience nuclear war since 1945. And so we don't actually know whether leaders would push the button or not.
Very worrisome. Michael Cordesman, let me go back to you. As you said, you think we're a year away from a more, potentially more lethal weapon. What should be done in that meantime? Is it a matter of sitting down with the leadership in North Korea? Is it a matter of freezing what they already have, or something more threatening than that?
I don't think there's one answer. As Michael has pointed out, we can't read the minds or in some ways even predict in broad terms how the North Korean regime is going to proceed. And it ultimately seems to be a regime of one, although he certainly is going to take advice and seems to have taken advice from his military staff. I think first you want to make it clear to North Korea that whatever happens, all it can do is raise the ante, the level of conflict and damage it would receive if it proceeds and goes on deploying. And let me say, just to clarify a point, I wasn't talking about American levels of reliability. They haven't even clearly shown they have a reentry vehicle. So until they do the basics, they don't have a credible threat. That's something that we will probably be able to detect and characterize. So that gives us some time, but should we seek negotiations? Well, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and the National Security Advisor have all said we should. And I think it's clear if we can, anything that would be a freeze, that would trade some kind of guarantees that we won't try to change the regime or somehow launch an invasion, perhaps some kind of economic incentives, if these could work, they're worth offering. It's not clear they can. We've offered them twice before, and they failed twice. The other thing that we can do is
only because we're almost up in a break here, and I don't want to interrupt you mid-answer. That is Anthony Cordesman. He's the Arleigh A. Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Also with us, Michael Horowitz. He's a professor of political science, associate director of Perry World House. That's at the University of Pennsylvania. Co-author of a book titled Why Leaders Fight. We are talking about the crisis in the Korean Peninsula, some of the options on the table. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the challenges that North Korea poses to the U.S., the possible path to a peaceful resolution of the conflict. And a little bit later in the hour, we'll be talking about what life is like for most North Koreans. Anthony Cordesman, you wanted to make your point, and I know Michael Horowitz wants to add to that as well. We're talking about how to resolve some of this conflict.
Let me just finish by saying what we really are going to do, because we've already done the planning here, and South Korea and Japan seem to be committed to it, is create a seamless structure of deterrence, not simply at the nuclear level in terms of extended deterrence, nuclear guarantees to South Korea and Japan, missile defense, but you want to convince North Korea that there's no way it can have lower thresholds of military attack. You want to improve the air defense capabilities. You want to ensure that they believe we will actually deploy and are capable of deploying quick, massive reinforcements for conventional conflict. You don't want to leave them any window where they feel that somehow they can exploit a given level of escalation And the best way, if we can ever get to negotiation, to get to negotiations, is to have that level of deterrence.
I mean, Michael Horowitz, any negotiation, there's going to be give and take. There are things on the table that are points of compromise. How do you see this?
I think one of the biggest challenges in negotiating with North Korea is that they don't – what we normally offer countries is a threat to them. What the United States normally has to offer countries are economic inducements that include both aid and opening up to the rest of the world. Access to world markets, access to the United States, exchanges, those sorts of things. The problem is that that's a threat to the Kim regime. That's a threat to Kim because shining the light on North Korea involves making their people more free, which I know you're going to get into later in the hour, but
yes.
that's a threat to the Kim regime. And so that really limits the sorts of carrots, the sorts of inducements that the U.S. has to try to leverage North Korean behavior. And so then thus what North Korea asks for often are things like freezes of U.S. military operations, like the U.S.-South Korean exercises that are planned for next week. But that's a huge ask. These are defensive exercises. They're a symbol of the U.S. commitment to South Korea. And to make a concession, that size concession to North Korea would just invite them to ask for more. And so the challenge is that even though we want an off-ramp, it's not clear what exactly the U.S. has to give that North Korea would want.
What about all the attention that the U.S. is focusing on North Korea? Does that give its leadership and perhaps Kim himself what he wants, to be seen as a strong man?
I mean, to the extent that being seen as negotiating and dealing with the United States, gives him credibility with domestic constituencies and domestic audiences. And that could be in some ways what North Korea wants in the first place. But that's troubling because that just encourages a relationship where they're encouraged to threaten us, because it's through those threats that they get that attention and thus, get what Kim seems to want.
Anthony Cordesman, the UN has imposed, and it was unanimous, I should say, some tougher new sanctions on North Korea. Is that an effective tool? And I was asking Michael Horowitz before the show, when has sanctions worked the way that we want them, thinking of Cuba and some other countries that we've imposed sanctions on?
One has to be careful. The history of international relations is rarely a history of things working out exactly the way anyone wanted them.
Right, exactly.
But I think sanctions have a mixed record. And, of course, the question is how much leverage do you get? A lot of that depends on China. And it depends on, even if China does fully comply, is this enough to push the North Korean regime into actually changing its behavior? Mm-hmm. I thought Michael outlined very clearly some of the problems here. One possible choice is that China obviously has preserved a very strong state regime by offering incentives to its people. But it's not clear North Korea can do anything like that. It's also unclear exactly how the leader perceives the situation. When he first came to power, people thought of him as a potential reformer, someone who would shift to a more focused economic approach. But in many ways, he's done just the opposite, and to reverse course now presents a real credibility problem. So it isn't how strong the sanctions are. It's an economy which already has suffered for decades, being willing to put militarization and the leader before any of the normal popular values.
Are you saying the people would suffer even more under these sanctions, or there's that possibility?
When you have an income this fragile, the only advantage it has is there are many people in rural areas who have almost nothing to lose. The level of electrification, modern development in good parts of North Korea simply aren't that high. But for people in urban areas, people who are dependent on civil services provided by the government, these sanctions will affect the economy simply because it's so fragile, the per capita income is so low, and all of the things that we kind of take for granted as coming from the private sector simply don't exist.
Michael, I know you want to add something. Go ahead.
Sure. I was just going to add that we haven't really gotten into China's role here yet. And, you know, as Anthony was sort of outlining a little bit, China's a key supporter of North Korea, both economically and politically. And President Trump is attempting to ratchet up pressure on China to place pressure on North Korea to fully implement the sanctions. The challenge is that China's interests here, not necessarily America's interests. You know, China, from what we can tell, at least I should say, from what we can tell, China doesn't want a nuclearized North Korea. China doesn't want North Korea getting into a conflict with the United States. But China also doesn't want North Korea collapsing and millions of refugees flooding into China. And China also doesn't want North Korea collapsing and U.S. troops to end up on the Yalu River. Like we did that in the early 1950s, and you know, that's a really dangerous world.
Yes, it is.
And so I think one of the big challenges here is how is it that you convince China to ratchet up pressure on North Korea to fully implement these sanctions and reduce its economic ties without making China feel like they're accelerating the risk of the collapse of North Korea?
Very, very tricky. Let me read a comment from Grady saying, does South Korea or Japan have Navy SEALs that could eliminate Kim Jong-un? And I guess to you, Anthony Cordesman, is that a solution to get rid of the dear leader of North Korea, the DPRK?
I don't think the system is so fragile that removing one man would somehow make the country collapse. The problem is that if the attack failed, you would almost immediately create a massive military reaction on the part of North Korea, and exactly where the escalation would stop would be difficult to predict. And if it does succeed, it's not clear their behavior would be any different. It also sets a precedent where a North Korea with some of the largest special forces and infiltration capabilities of any country in the world would almost have carte blanche, an excuse to take its own actions in reprisal. It's just not clear, A, it would work, and B, where it would stop.
And we're talking about a million or so active soldiers, something like 200,000 paramilitary forces. So clearly one of the largest military armies, soldiers, in the world, right, Anthony Cordesman?
That's right. But I think what really counts here is the sort of special forces, the intelligence people, the kind of operators that would do covert operations. This is a country that has made that a major element of its military forces. And Korea certainly has, South Korea, some excellent special forces, intelligence people on its own. I think Japan would certainly choose to avoid this. But again, once you start something like this, you do have to consider how you're going to stop it.
That's Anthony Cordesman, Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And joining us also, Michael Horowitz from the University of Pennsylvania, co-authored a book called Why Leaders Fight. And we are talking about the crisis, such as it is this morning in North Korea, some of the possibilities, paths for some kind of a peaceful resolution. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Michael, let me ask you a couple of questions about your book. And I looked at your TED Talk from about a year ago, where you talk about the why leaders fight, essentially what are the characteristics of a leader that would lead a country to war or not. One of them had to do with age. One of them had to do with military or combat experience. But I'm interested in how you see a 32-year-old who's the head of the DPRK, Kim Jong-un, and a 70-year-old head of the United States, obviously President Donald Trump.
So what we did in Why Leaders Fight was build a model that included 35 different background characteristics of world leaders, everything from military experience to age to, you know, marriage, kids, upbringing, and use that to try to estimate statistically over a data set of 2,500 leaders the relative impact of leader experiences on how countries behave. And And for Kim Jong-un, one of the things that our results suggest is that as a young leader in an autocracy who doesn't have really anything in the way of real military experience, but I think he's like appointed as a general prior to, you know, just prior to, you know, appointed to the military just prior to becoming the head of state, our research suggests that actually could be a pretty dangerous sort of leader, because leaders who believe that they understand the military but haven't faced the dangers of combat tend to romanticize the military in a way that makes them a little more likely to use military force. And turning to Donald Trump, Donald Trump is like in many ways in American politics, Donald Trump was really challenging for our model, in that Donald Trump really is truly unusual among American presidents in his extreme lack of prior political experience. And so there wasn't a lot for the model to grasp onto. You know, he doesn't have any prior military experience. He didn't have any prior political experience. You know, he's a businessman who's been married several times, I think has five children. And so he actually showed up in our model, consistent with his America First rhetoric, as somebody more akin to Calvin Coolidge in actual his propensity to use sort of military force, which is in contrast, I think, to some of the rhetoric that we're seeing. Reluctant to use force, that he seemed more isolationist according to our model. But I will also say that the error bars in our model, the degree of error that our model associated with predictions for Donald Trump was a lot higher than it was for, say, a Hillary Clinton presidency, where there's just so much life experience there that the model could do, a better job predicting the kind of foreign policy president she would be. There's just a lot of uncertainty about Donald Trump, and that's the way he likes it.
No question about it. Here's an email from Dave to you, Anthony Cordesman. He says, at the risk of being naive, couldn't the U.S. and South Korea suspend military exercises? I've heard from reliable sources that North Korea has offered to freeze its nuclear program if we stop the war games. What do you say to Dave?
Well, first, it's very unclear that North Korea has made such an offer. Again, we go back to rhetoric versus negotiating reality. It has said that this might be a step which would lead it to alter or reduce the pace of its activity. It hasn't said it would give up missile development. It hasn't said it would give up the development and production of nuclear weapons. So that is a critical issue. The other problem here is often people talk about these as if they were massive exercises. Actually, they're very limited exercises given the potential threat that North Korea poses to South Korea. You're bringing just enough U.S. people in to show that you have a clear intention, but more importantly, to keep up the ability to move forces in quickly and effectively. And while most people wouldn't remember it, in the start of the Korean War, we hadn't done that. And we sent in something called Task Force Smith, and it got decimated by the North Koreans. You can't sort of have military credibility without military exercises.
It's interesting when we're talking about North Korea, the conversation naturally goes to China, but I'm thinking, Michael Horowitz, what about South Korea? What kind of say do they have in this conflict?
South Korea has a lot of say, and one of the things you've seen over the last day is the South Korean leadership making the case that war isn't going to happen on the Korean Peninsula without their agreeing to it. You know, at least a war that the United States and South Korea would start. And in some ways, one of North Korea's goals, like when North Korea asks for the U.S. and South Korea to stop its exercises, what they're really trying to do is drive a wedge between the United States and South Korea. They want to deal with the United States alone. They don't want to have to deal with South Korea. And so South Korea's role here is vital, and the strength of the U.S.-South Korean relationship is a critical part of how the U.S. And its allies deter North Korea. And it's one of the reasons why actually freezing exercises could be so risky. But South Korea has very clearly asserted its prerogative over the last couple of days, and you know, they would be involved in any decision to go to war on the part of the United States.
We touched on this earlier in the hour, but here's an email. This is for you, Michael Horowitz. North Korea seemed to step back from the brink by toning down its bellicose rhetoric in a public statement. Is this evidence that Trump's strategy worked? I put that to Anthony Cordesman. What do you say?
I don't think it's evidence that Trump's strategy worked. I mean, one problem you have is what strategy? Just saying that you are going to sort of massively retaliate or take military threats undefined that you haven't prepared for or demonstrated you're willing to use, that is not by itself a strategy. But if you talk about U.S. strategy in a broader sense, I think the fact that we have shown we are willing and fully committed to South Korea, that's something that I think is the president's clear signal to both South Korea and North Korea and the entire region, not something that's been caught up in the discussion over this crisis. And it is reiterating a strategy that we've maintained for decades.
And let me just jump in here, only because we have about 30 seconds, and I know Michael Horowitz wants to add something. Go ahead, Michael.
Say there are two sides to this. I think on the one hand, as I mentioned before, and consistent with what Anthony said, clear U.S. signals that North Korean aggression will not be tolerated are critical to deterrence. And to the extent that President Trump did that, I think that consistent with what other U.S. presidents have done, I think that certainly was helpful. The challenge is that the other side of the coin is signaling to North Korea that if they are not provocative, that there won't be a conflict. And I think to the extent that people were concerned with President Trump's remarks, the concerns were that he wasn't signaling a clear off-ramp.
On that note, Michael Horowitz, thanks for coming in. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Anthony Cordesman, thank you for joining us as well.
A pleasure.
And we will talk about, after this very short break, what life is like in North Korea for regular North Koreans. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moskowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. North Korea is home to some 25 million people with no civil rights, a barely functioning economy, where many are food insecure and malnourished, largely cut off from the outside world. Our guest, Dr. Suzanne Schulte, is one of the leading activists for North Korean human rights. She's president of the Defense Forum Foundation, serves as honorary chair of a radio station run by dissidents. It's called Free North Korea Radio. She's chair and founding member of the North Korea Freedom Coalition, and she joins us on Radio Times. And Suzanne Schulte, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. I'm very, very excited to be with you this morning.
Well, we're happy to have you as well. Let me just give out that phone number if people have any questions or comments. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me ask you, because I've seen news reports of official ceremonies. They tend to be in the capital, Pyongyang. These are events. I see well-dressed people. They seem well-fed. They're smiling. They're cheering their dear leader. Take us outside of these events, outside of the Capitol. What is life like for most North Koreans?
A daily struggle to survive. And this North Korea is the only country in the world that does not enjoy a single human right as enshrined by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And what that means is they don't have the right to travel, the right to choose their employment, to choose where they could live, to read a newspaper they want to read, or to listen to a foreign radio broadcast. They're so cut off and isolated. And because of that, this is why you see such a terrible suffering for the population in North Korea. They also have as many have recognized now, this expansive network of political prison camps, where three generations of a family can be sent. If one member of the family has committed a crime would be defined as listening to a foreign radio broadcast, not showing proper respect to Kim Jong-un, questioning authority. It's just the most repressive, darkest place on earth. But I do want to say there's amazing changes that have happened in Marty, and when we get to that point, I'd like to bring up some of the things that the North Korean people have done to change things internally.
Absolutely. And I just want to add a couple of other things about the food insecurity or malnutrition or even starvation. And I saw a talk that you gave where you described the millions of people who have died of starvation in North Korea in a country that was not at war, and how unusual, how shockingly unusual that is.
Absolutely. That has never happened in human history, that you've had a population that has suffered massive starvation in the absence of war. And that's what happened in North Korea when they lost the support of, when the Soviet Union collapsed and they lost that financial support from the Soviet Union. They went through a period where they went through massive starvations. Millions of people died. There's a lot of disputes about the number, but I absolutely believe it was at least 3 million, probably more, because Hwang Jong-yap, the highest-ranking defector who defected in the late 1990s, that's what he said, and he would have been in a position to know. But the reason why that starvation occurred is because of the regime. Their poor agricultural policies, the fact that they wouldn't allow access to food. The international community sent enough humanitarian aid to North Korea during that period, not a single person needed to starve. And yet there was massive starvation, and it was because the regime orchestrated that, cutting off whole sections of North Korea that it considered disloyal from receiving any humanitarian aid.
So it
was a terrible period.
So food is a weapon?
Absolutely. The Kim regime has used food as a weapon against the people of North Korea. And one of the things that's happened that's changed dramatically, it's very significant, is that the North Korean people used to get their food through the public distribution system. And this was a mechanism, one of their mechanisms of control, in addition to isolating the country, the political prisoner camps for dissidents. But what they did through the Sungbong classification system, which is this elaborate classification system, 52 different categories, three main, where you have loyal, wavering, and hostile. And that's how food and material goods were distributed. So if you were part of the loyal crowd, you would live in Pyongyang and you would have access to material goods and food. But if you were wavering, it would be questionable. But if you were hostile, you may be cut off from any kind of food. So this is one of the methods of control. Well, what happened during this period, when this massive starvation was occurring in North Korea, what the North Korean people did was amazing. And I credit the women of North Korea. The women of North Korea created a market system in order to survive, of trading and selling, and all spread out throughout the entire country. The Kim Jong-il regime at the time did everything it could to try to control these markets that were springing up all over. Just out of the sheer self-determination of trying to survive, these markets sprung up, and the regime couldn't control them. And they finally gave up in 2009 and backed away after a currency devaluation. They backed away and decided to allow these markets to function. Now, why this is important? It's because the people are no longer dependent on the regime for survival. They're dependent on each other. And this is incredible development. And I know that when people look at North Korea, they see a very dark place. But I've devoted all my life to helping the people of North Korea, and I see the amazing things that they've done. And that's just one of them. But the other thing that's changed dramatically inside North Korea is they're no longer cut off. We think of them, and we've described them as a hermit kingdom of people that are slavishly devoted to the Kim dictatorship. But the truth is that they are so hungry for information from the outside world that they are learning about the outside world, and it's changing their view. For example, they're raised from childhood to hate America and to believe that South Korea is occupied by the United States, and that we're Yankee imperialist wolves that control and occupy South Korea, and that South Korea is way far behind North Korea. And that's what the propaganda that they're fed. Well, now that so much information has gotten into North Korea, and this is because the people of North Korea want to know what's going on, they're watching South Korean soap operas, they're watching Western movies, they're listening to foreign radio broadcasts, they have an elaborate system of where they're smuggling things in, USBs with soap operas and movies on them that they're watching, and this is all being done by the North Koreans themselves. And a lot of the defectors are involved in this kind of work, and that's why I'm a big supporter of Free North Korea Radio, or I should say our foundation is. And Free North Korea Radio is a broadcast every day in
North Seoul, Korea. Right? Out of Seoul?
Out of Seoul, yes, ma'am. It's produced in Seoul by North Korean defectors. But the shortwave transmission is supported 100% by Americans and Korean-American churches. It's an amazing partnership between North Korean defectors and Americans to get information into North Korea so they understand the truth. And today, August 15th, Liberation Day, we just sent in messages from members of Congress sharing hopes and dreams that we have as Americans for the people of North Korea. And that's what I get so worried about with all the rhetoric, that we're losing sight of the suffering of the people of North Korea and the defectors, over 30,000 have escaped, that are trying to change that nation by getting information in and getting people to understand the truth that America is not their enemy. So this is one of the things that we're very much engaged in through getting information,
sure.
balloon launches and every method possible.
Let me pick up on a couple of things. I'm curious about the radio station, obviously, because we're talking on the radio, but also about these USB that get smuggled into North Korea without giving away a dangerous information. How does that happen?
Well, there's North Koreans that have the travel permits, that have the ability to cross over the border into China. There's a lot of trade going on through the China-North Korea border. And the traders are generally people that in North Korea that have the permission to be able to go there, and it's just money talks. And the popularity of this information is so strong, they actually have gotten to the point where North Koreans will order like certain episodes of some South Korea soap opera they want to watch, and these traders will go and go back and forth over the border and get this information. But they're using USBs, SD cards. There's a small computer called a Notel, which lost popularity in China but is very popular in North Korea. And the government actually allows people to own Notels. Notels are a media player that you can use SD cards and USBs, but you can also watch movies. And what they'll do is the North Korean will pretend they're watching North Korea propaganda if the minders or the State Security Bureau agents are trying to surveil what that person's watching. And they can pull out that USB of the South Korean soap opera they may have been watching and hide that. So it's a very popular way for people to get information.
And are there minders that come to people? How would the North Korean government know what people are watching on their computers or their televisions?
Well, there's constant surveillance of the citizens of North Korea. They're constantly under surveillance, and they're constantly monitoring what people are watching. One of the things that people will be reported that it might be reported that some family was watching a foreign media, or whatever, and the state security agent may show up and interview them or take them in for questioning. But it's very much monitored. Shortwave, the radio program we do is done on shortwave. One of the beauties of the radio, which is still very important when you're trying to get information into a closed society like North Korea, is unless they catch you in the act of listening, it's very hard to determine that somebody's been listening on the shortwave. There is equipment that they're developing in North Korea to try to catch people doing that. But from what I understand, if they're it's very difficult to pick up that they're picking up watching a shortwave transmission.
Wow.
And so that's one of the reasons why we think the radio is really important. But I believe that when it comes to North Korea, you have to do balloon launches too, which is very controversial. But the balloon launches are why the North Koreans know about Otto Warmbier's death, because the North Korean defectors have taken it upon themselves to get information in North Korea, and they send in hundreds of thousands of leaflets about what happened to Otto Warmbier so that people in North Korea would know that this young man was murdered by the Kim regime.
You mentioned the fact that people are watching soap operas, and we should not be surprised about that. People want to be entertained even if they live in harsh circumstances. Could a family risk prison camp for being caught watching a soap opera in North Korea?
Yes, absolutely. Watching media, absolutely. But people are so hungry for information, and I'm going to just give you one example. The movie Titanic.
Yes.
Became a sensation in North Korea. I know defectors that were almost arrested for watching that movie. And in one case, this woman who lived in Pyongyang, so she lived in the capital city, she was part of the elites, she watched the movie with her husband. It got reported. The State Security Bureau agent showed up at her door and said, if you give me the movie, I won't turn you in, because everybody wanted to watch that movie. That movie was a life-changing experience for a lot of North Koreans, because they had never conceptualized the idea of sacrificing oneself for love. Sacrificing for the dictator, yes, you're brainwashed from childhood to do that. But that movie depicted sacrificial love, and so it was revolutionizing their thoughts. So the regime was so intimidated by that concept, they came up with their own propaganda about the Titanic, and they announced to the people of North Korea the movie was not a love story. It was about the death of capitalism, because the Titanic sank on April 12, 1915, the same day that Kim Il-sung was born. So they tried to twist it into propaganda for the regime. But that's how threatened they are by people listening to foreign radio broadcasts, watching Western movies and South Korean soap operas. But that information going in is what's opening up the minds of the people of North Korea. And I am so encouraged by what the defectors are doing with no support. They're doing this all on their own, getting information in every possible way, because they keep telling us the truth will set them free. The defectors who've escaped say that to me all the time. Our people in North Korea just need to know the truth. It's the truth that shall set them free. We've got to get them information.
And Suzanne,
that's why I'm so focused on that.
Sure, and we're only about a minute before we have to say goodbye. Obviously, we are still living with a kind of tension between the U.S. and North Korea. Do you think what these dissidents are doing, what the North Korean people are doing, is going to have a bigger effect than whatever the U.S. does?
Absolutely. In fact, what we're doing right now, the messages we're sending in for August 15th, Liberation Day, is basically saying, Japan, we're liberated from Japan, South Korea got their freedom, but North Korea is still living under tyranny, because they changed over from one dictatorship to another. And what we're saying in these messages is that we want the people of North Korea, this is what the defectors are saying, North Korean defectors who served in the military are calling on the North Koreans serving in the military today to stand up against the dictatorship in favor of the people, telling them about what happened in Egypt, telling them about what happened in Romania, mm-hmm. telling them about the fact that America wants to work with North Korea and wants the people there to have the same freedom and human rights that people in South Korea and America have, that we're not their enemy and we're not bent on their destruction. We actually care about them. They're pointing out things like all the aid, the humanitarian aid that we've sent there, because we didn't want anybody to starve, giving them the truth. And that's what the defectors are doing. And I think that's the most important thing that we should be doing.
Suzanne Schulte, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. President of the Defense Forum Foundation. She's also chair of the North Korea Freedom Coalition and a Seoul Peace Prize laureate. And she's also honorary chair of a radio station run by North Korean dissidents. Comes out of Seoul and is called Free North Korea Radio. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. And you can find out much more about this program, about certainly how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.